And our special guest, Linda Moulton Howe, she's got several more incredible stories for you before we go into conversations with Linda next hour on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Now, Linda, the boom story.
Thank you, dear sir.
Yeah.
So I'll never try to do a fast run to my computer ever again.
Gotcha.
This month of April 2014, I have been getting so many different reports from literally coast to coast, northern border, southern border in this country of people who continue to hear these strange, mysterious boom sounds. These are separate from the metallic and trumpet sounds. Sometimes they're all mixed, but along with these boom reports, there have been unexpected swarms of earthquakes in central Idaho, in Yellowstone, central Oklahoma, and there was that big 7.2 in southern Mexico just a little while ago. So there is seismic activity and a big Texas sinkhole in Winkler County.
Mm-hmm.
It has grown to almost 1,000 feet in diameter and 125 feet deep.
God, they had a big one in Detroit, too. Detroit, of all places.
That's right, and they're having them in lots of places, not just in the United States, but the world. And in this Winkler County in Texas, the sheriff is warning that this is really dangerous. The roads are moving, George. There are huge crevices that have formed in the ground, and no one knows why or how much bigger this sinkhole there is going to grow. And then recently on April 16th, just about a week ago, media in New Hampshire reported that residents within a 20-mile radius of Keene, New Hampshire, were complaining that a loud noise was shaking their houses shortly after 2 p.m. Now, this is in the afternoon, so we have nighttime booms, morning booms, midday booms. A public affairs spokesman at Barnes Air National Guard Base in Westfield was contacted by the TV stations and media and said that, yes, there were F-15 Eagles doing civil exercises over southern New Hampshire, but none of them had broken the sound barrier. There still, as of this day, is no explanation to what caused the loud booms that was heard by many, many people in New Hampshire on April 16th. And then the week before that, approximately, in Dinwiddie, Virginia, I received this from a resident there. Just yesterday, I heard 12 booms. The first occurred at about 6:30 p.m. while my wife and I were watching a movie. It was so loud that it startled our cats. It shook the house so much that I stepped outside to see if something had happened. I saw nothing, so I went back inside, and we continued watching the movie. But we continued hearing booms, which varied only slightly in intensity until about 11:30 in the evening. And every single one shook the whole house. In Davenport, Iowa, KWQC-TV was flooded with reports from residents saying, I heard a really loud boom. I expected to see a mushroom cloud when I went outside. I haven't heard anything that loud since leaving Iraq in 2007. Whether the noise was a rumble, explosion, or boom, many of you are telling us this is not the first time you've heard it. And as of today, it is still a mystery. That was KWQC. And in Colorado, just to give an idea, Pueblo, a man writes, booms returned again last night. This is April 7th. I didn't notice the booms. I did notice the booms are coming from the northern direction, seemingly from the Colorado Springs area where I live, and it was close to midnight. Now, that's now, and you know, Coast audience knows, Earth Files, I have been reporting about these booms since sort of a beginning in my files of January 2011. I have no idea what exactly was happening that started all of this. Remember when we did the reports about the thousands of red-winged blackbirds that fell
from the sky? Yeah.
Okay, and then it went from that New Year's Eve for weeks. There were thousands of birds in various places falling out of the sky and very unusual animal deaths. And what were they associated with? Loud booms. Well, recently, scientists have reported that the speed at which the inner core of our planet rotates can change over time. No one knows why. But last year, when that Utah geophysicist whistleblower contacted me through an intermediary, and I was talking on Coast and at Earth Files about his telling me that he was doing secret top secret investigations for the U.S. government, and that he was suggesting that inner Earth core changes were causing the booms and the strange metallic sounds because of a phenomena that he's been studying, in which, the way he laid it out, infrasound vibrations, which normally cannot be heard by the human ear, are coming from inside the Earth, from core changes coming up to the mantle, reaching the Earth's crust, continuing up through the atmosphere to the ionosphere, and then bouncing back in a form that can be heard in isolated places. Now, I laid that out. I went to Adriana Gleason, a geophysics professor at Stanford University, presented that information. She is one of the scientists in the past 12 months who has had published research on her work concerning the Earth's core. And what she has found is that where they thought that the Earth's core was turning in a sphere, that now the measurements are saying it's lopsided. And could this lopsided change in the shape of the Earth's core, for unknown reasons, suddenly be emanating infrasound in exactly the way that the geophysicist through the intermediary had been talking to me? And at least Professor Gleason did not dismiss that. She said that the hypothesis of infrasound coming up through the mantle to the ionosphere and bouncing back was at least reasonable for research. Now, recently, in the last 2 or 3 weeks, I have learned new information that infrasound can become audible to the human ear when infrasound waves overlap with another kind of wave that travels through solid surfaces like the Earth's crust. And that is called a Rayleigh wave, R-A-Y-L-E-I-G-H, Rayleigh wave. Now, these are produced often when there are earthquakes. And we know that in so many of these boom phenomena, not only are they not sonic booms for military, but USGS is asked in every single one.
We've got 25 seconds, Linda, to the
top. All right, and the answer is not seismic. Well, an infrasound that normally cannot be heard by the ear might be amplified in the presence of Rayleigh waves. And here now to talk about this, Rayleigh and infrasound, is Professor Alfred Bedard, PhD. He is the infrasonics group leader at the NOAA Earth System Research Lab in Boulder, Colorado.
If you have an infrasonic detector and a Rayleigh wave goes by, it's as if the sound sensor is sitting on a loudspeaker, and the Rayleigh wave is locally radiating infrasound again. And that infrasound radiates into the atmosphere almost vertically. That's why typically if you're at a distance, you don't detect these Rayleigh wave-generated infrasound at all.
But somebody locally right at that spot could hear it.
Yes, that's right, could detect it. If the frequencies of the seismic waves were much higher than Rayleigh wave frequencies, then it might be audible.
The fact that dogs have anticipated the coming boom by whining, some have run under beds, some have run to doors and pawed. The owners are confused, they don't know why, and then comes the loud boom. So that means that the dogs are hearing something that's driving them crazy before the boom is audible to humans.
A lot of creatures can hear infrasound.
How would infrasound change rapidly from not being audible to a boom?
Okay, let's pretend that there's some, we don't know what it is, but at some distance, there's a source. It could be seismic or it could be something else, and it creates infrasound, and then the larger scale is infrasound, and then there are small scale disturbances as well, which create audible sound. So if the infrasound traveled and occurred first, then the dog might be sensitive to that. And then particularly if there's a inversion layers, I don't know how many of these reports are at night compared to the daytime, but an inversion layer can trap acoustic waves extremely efficiently and cause them to be focused. So you might find these situations where all of a sudden somebody on the south end of the street can hear the sound and somebody up the street further can't hear it. So you can get a lot of focusing and defocusing from inversion layers and wind shear layers trapping sound in complex ways.
The reports have literally been every hour around a clock at any time. I have not seen any pattern to the time. But the question that would remain, what is the source causing the infrasound? Lava in the mantle might produce infrasound. What makes something stay at 20 hertz or lower versus being audible to the human ear?
The ear is highly nonlinear, so you could take a 20 hertz sound, and if it was strong enough, it would be moving the ear sensing diaphragm back and forth through a nonlinear region. You can cause something called intermodulation distortion, which means it would end up distorting the sounds that were in the background and causing them to be increased in amplitude and decreased, and the frequency of the modulation would be at the frequency of the sound that was causing it. Maybe this 20 hertz sound that was extremely powerful, that was inaudible, wasn't causing audible sound, but what it was doing was modulating the ear's ability to hear what would be normally background sounds that would be at low level.
So it might be targeted to an individual at that moment in that place, and that might explain why one or two people are experiencing this as a huge boom phenomena, but the neighbors next door aren't hearing anything.
That could be. And this is an area, I think, where research is just starting. There's an article in a publication called Acoustics Today, published by the Acoustical Society of America. And the latest one just came out. I think it's the April issue. And there's a discussion in there about how infrasound affects the ear in different ways and can be sensed in different ways. I think it relates to the questions you're bringing up.
What would focus the infrasound down to just a house?
You can think of this as a sonic boom. The basic waveform of a sonic boom from the SSTs that were on the drawing board, supersonic transports, the duration of the sonic boom was 100 to 200 milliseconds. So you're talking about an infrasonic impulse, and that leading edge of that sonic boom was very sharp, and that's the audible part of it, but the infrasonic part of it was the general form of the N wave. So if you had something like that focused, you could have all the energy concentrated in an extremely small area. So you're dealing with somebody exposed to both infrasound and the leading edge of the sharp impulse, which is in the audible region. There could be many, many mechanisms all contributing to these reports.
So infrasound can focus down to a small area and at that area be audible to the human ear, even if the rest of the infrasound wave is not?
If you have a certain type of signature, and that's the supersonic boom from a N wave. In other words, anything that produces an impulse like an N wave from a supersonic aircraft, could be a meteor, it could be an explosion, will have a infrasonic component, as in the leading edge could have energy in the audible.
Well, that certainly seems for the first time to be describing something that could explain these strange variations of so many of these booms experienced by one house and not a whole neighborhood. And now the mystery is, what would be causing the infrasound pulse with a leading edge that could be heard in one house and not others?
I really don't know, but a lot of research went into the sonic boom. And some of the N waves had no sharp edges on the leading edge or the trailing edge, and others had spikes. Sometimes they appeared on the leading edge, and sometimes they appeared on the trailing edge. And these spikes are the things that would be audible. So one explanation for the existence of these spikes was as the sonic boom came down from above through atmospheric turbulence, that contributed to these spikes that would be acoustic, audible, being able to be heard. So that's one possibility.
In Wikipedia is this sentence under infrasound. One study has suggested that infrasound may cause feelings of awe or fear in humans, close quote.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
There is a controversy. This dates back to the 70s, and people at Wright-Patterson did a study with seasoned Marine pilots, fighter pilots, and they had them exposed to infrasound, and they proved that infrasound was not a problem whatsoever. Well, all of a sudden, what they did was sort out from the population the very people who probably were most immune to vibration sensitivity and things like that. And then other investigators found extreme responses in people where there was dizziness, nausea, all kinds of physiological effects. I get calls very frequently from people who are encountering major medical problems. They often will attribute it to humming sounds or low-frequency vibrations of various kinds.
How would you, with all your experience with researching and studying infrasound, how would you go about trying to understand what could be behind all of this past 3-year phenomena that could be explained by infrasound and that leading edge that can become audible?
Since it happened sporadically and not anything that you could predict the exact time, what's required is some sort of real-time monitoring for a long enough period so that you can detect some of these things. And then you need an array, or else you can't tell what direction the sound is coming from. So you need an array of sensitive detectors, need the patience to deploy for a long period of time, and then the resources to be able to analyze the data, not just collect it, and be able to characterize the background in the region. And I think then you probably will end up wanting not just one of these sensing systems, but maybe several, so you can triangulate and tell something about where the source is coming from, where the signals are originating from. All of that requires a decent amount of effort.
Do you think it's possible the changes in the inner core and perhaps the outer core of this planet could be responsible for this new rash of booms and strange sounds that can be as isolated as one house on a block of houses?
The picture that you are painting about the core being dynamic, it sounds very reasonable, but what the implications of core dynamics are, the idea that we're still learning about our reality, that's not surprising.
Amazing story. If you hear these booms, check in with us during our phone call portion with Linda. We're going to come back with more on the mystery of Flight 370. Okay, next hour we will have conversations with Linda. Those of you who are calling now, hold off. We'll do it next hour. Questions for her and possibly some leads that she can take on to look for some other stories. We're going to come back in a moment, though, and talk with her about another one of her reports on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe with us. And by the way, as we get into this story with Linda about the Malaysia Jet 370, there are reports that a Virgin Blue passenger plane has just been hijacked, forced to land at the Bali Airport. Passenger tried to enter the cockpit after the plane took off from Brisbane. We do not know what else is going on. Linda, go ahead with your report.
Wow.
Yeah.
That may or may not be relevant in the sense of the Prime Minister of Malaysia today in an interview told CNN that he wasn't prepared because this bizarre scenario of MH370 is so strange that he was not prepared to definitively say that the 239 people aboard are dead. Leaving sort of a strange door open at the same time that they have denied sharing their preliminary report with the public and all of the relatives. It's a very odd move by Malaysia today.
Yep.
Well, let's go back just a little bit and set the stage again for what happened. MH370, the Malaysian airline pilot's captain, was Zahari Ahmad Shah. He was 53 years old when on Friday, March 7th, 2014, he traveled from his Kuala Lumpur home, drove 15 miles to Pattaya to attend the trial of his friend, a Malaysian opposition leader, Anwar Ibrahim. Captain Shah was enraged when Ibrahim was sentenced to 5 years in jail on a homosexuality charge. After sentencing at 9 p.m. on what would have been March 7th, angry Zahari Shah drove to the Kuala Lumpur airport. As the clock went past midnight to 12:41 a.m. Saturday, March 8th, Captain Shah took off in MH370. He and his crew numbered 12. There were 227 passengers for a total of 239 people bound for Beijing, China, 2,700 miles away to the north. The 777's fuel tanks were full and could cruise at 35,000 feet for about 7 hours, and then there would be no more gas in the tanks. About 41 minutes later, at 1:30 a.m., air traffic control lost contact with MH370 over the Gulf of Thailand. Was there a catastrophic mechanical problem? Or was the transponder deliberately shut off at 1:30 a.m. for nefarious reasons? Or did something else happen? And as I said today, the Prime Minister of Malaysia said that he felt this was a bizarre scenario. He was not prepared to tell CNN that he definitely would say that the 239 people were dead. And he said this: how could a plane that was supposed to head toward Beijing end up so far in the opposite direction, quote, halfway to Antarctica?
He's right.
Yeah. Well, some of the other big mysteries are why the roller coaster flight up to 40,000 feet and then down to 4,500 feet. Why did the co-pilot have his cell phone on the whole time? What was the reason for the sharp turn to the west and then down toward Perth, Australia? Why has there been no MH370 debris where pings were picked up by the Inmarsat satellite? Do the four ping areas reveal an overlap that pinpoints where there might be this plane? Joining me to analyze these mysteries from a quarter century of skilled U.S. Navy airborne navigation, search and rescue, and anti-submarine warfare experience is retired Navy Captain Mark Wood. He is now 64 graduated in 1971 from Georgia Tech in Atlanta with a Bachelor of Engineering degree in aerospace engineering. The next year, he trained as an overwater navigator, qualified in celestial navigation, and after being designated as a naval flight officer, was assigned to a U.S. Navy P-3C squadron at Moffett Field in California. For the next 25 years, Mark flew over 3,000 flight hours in three P-3 squadrons as a mission commander and tactical coordinator, ultimately becoming both an executive officer and commanding officer of two U.S. Naval Air Reserve units. After earning a master's degree in ocean engineering, Mark spent over 7 years involved with the design, installation, and repair of a variety of U.S. Navy submarine towed array sonars and U.S. Navy fixed array sonars and deep water remotely operated vehicles. He has also been on the faculty of Florida Atlantic University, where he taught ocean engineering and underwater sound, and served as the staff engineer at the Florida Institute of Oceanography, where he had responsibility for the operation of the State of Florida University System deep water research vessels. We began our discussion about the bizarre MH370 disappearance and what could possibly have been behind the 777 airliner climbing on radar to 45,000 feet and then back down to 4,500 feet. Here now is retired Navy Captain Mark Wood.
It was 1 o'clock in the morning, I think, local time. Most of the people were probably already beginning to doze or go to sleep for a night flight. They could gradually decrease the cabin altitude, incapacitate the emergency oxygen system in the cabin, stay on oxygen in the cockpit, and gradually people would fall asleep, become unconscious, and ultimately die. Since the plane continued to fly and there was no emergency call from the flight crew that they were having a problem, no doubt it was a deliberate event, and going to that altitude was done to incapacitate the passengers so that they wouldn't cause them any problems.
And at that altitude, 1 minute is all that they would have had before they were dead, and that the only person or people who could have survived would have been those who had oxygen masks.
Yes, and then rapidly descended to go down below 5,000 feet. They did it for two reasons. One is to get below radar, but the other was to get some warmth back in, because they weren't going to survive the cold even if they had oxygen masks on. And we're just hearing that the co-pilot's cell phone was on, and they made it sound like he tried to make a call but was not close to an antenna. If the pilot and the co-pilot got into an altercation and one or the other was trying to save the plane, it may have been that he had no choice but to try and call somebody on a cell phone because he wasn't able to get to the radios. It could have been turned on accidentally, or my feeling is that it was an attempt to communicate with somebody that something was not right. And what that tells me is that the pilot and the co-pilot were not acting together. It was one or the other that had taken over the plane. All we can assume is that it was for a hijacking. And the reason I say that is, if this was a suicide attempt, it wasn't necessary to climb to 40,000 feet. Whoever was in charge had to do was nose over and fly it right into the water in between Malaysia and Vietnam. And that wasn't done. They continued to fly for a number of hours. So there was some purpose for it to go where it went, unless the person was completely deranged. And until we get the black boxes and hear any of the conversation that took place, we won't know that.
Would you speculate why MH370 made that sharp turn going southwest?
Whoever took over the plane didn't want to have any contact at all, either radar or communication with Vietnam. So the way to do that was to turn away. The initial way to turn was towards the west, because they were going into an area that was probably more rural, maybe had poorer radar coverage. There weren't a lot of big cities, as opposed to flying back towards the east and then south, which would have taken them back over Kuala Lumpur, which isn't where you'd want to go.
Mm-hmm.
So I can understand that would be a place where there was probably a smaller likelihood of being tracked on radar
until they got down to where the military radar picked them up near one of the islands off the western coast of Malaysia.
Do you think, in speculation, that the goal might have been to do something in Perth, Australia, with that plane?
If the intent was to go to Australia, the only thing that I can think of is to have done some sort of damage.
Right.
Not unlike a 9/11 scenario. And if one would ask, well, why would they do that? The radical Islamic movement has not been welcome in Australia, as in many other countries. And it may be that this was somebody's idea of making a statement. I can't think of any other reason why they would have flown in that direction, because the only other alternative is to run out of fuel and put the plane in the water.
And Perth is the only really somewhat large city on the western coast of Australia. And if their intent was to do damage, do you think it is possible that it was linked with the pilot, his politics, and what he did?
I guess one thing that is sort of surprising is, since this friend who was in Malaysian politics, who was put in jail by the Malaysian government, one would think that they would take action against the Malaysian government and maybe fly into a building or something like that in Kuala Lumpur. Mm-hmm. So the fact that it didn't take that option and went down towards Australia, one would think that that could be a motive. And it would be interesting to see if there was any relationship between the gentleman who was put in jail, whether or not he had traveled to Australia. Did the Australian government help with evidence that caused him to go to jail? It doesn't make any sense to just fly south into the Indian Ocean and know you're going to run out of gas.
And so Perth is the only obvious target on the Western Australia coast.
Yeah, I would think so. I know there's a Royal Australian Air Force base up on the northwestern coast, but that's not something that would be known to most people. And obviously, if in fact the motive was to do something like this, have an Australian 9/11, you want to make the biggest impact you can.
Why do you think that there hasn't been any obvious MH370 debris where the pings have been?
Having spent a large portion of my Navy career doing maritime patrol, you would be surprised when you're flying at even several thousand feet at a couple of hundred knots. It's difficult to even see something as big as a 12-foot diameter life raft that's bright yellow.
Mm-hmm.
You've got wind and wave action. You've got white caps that are confusing. Things can bob up and bob down in a trough, and you fly right over them, and you don't see them until the third or fourth time you fly right back over the same location. That in itself complicates the problem. The other thing is that this aircraft, in my estimation, didn't explode, say, like TWA Flight 800 off Long Island, where you had massive amounts of debris that floated and stayed in an area for a long period of time. So most likely this went down in one piece, whether because it ran out of fuel or because the pilot finally decided to put it in the water. The area that it went down was basically the size of an airplane hitting the water, and at the speed that it went and hit, I would think that what would happen is that the wings would have been ripped off upon impact, and the fuselage would have just gone, you know, down like a lawn dart and not broken up into lots of pieces that would have come up and floated around the surface. Not to say that there wouldn't have been seat cushions or life vests or suitcases or even bodies, but I think most of the debris they will probably find, if they find the aircraft, it will probably still be in the fuselage.
And what would happen to the wings in that scenario?
Well, the impact of a plane hitting the water, even if it just ran out of fuel, nosed over, and went down, you're probably talking about several hundred knots at a minimum, maybe even as much as 300 knots. And the wings would have been definitely ripped off the fuselage. The engines would have been ripped off. There's nothing that would keep an engine floating. The landing gear, the engines would go right to the bottom. The wings, they would have been torn up to the point that the integrity of the fuel tanks would have been lost, and they'd have filled with water and sank.
That takes us now down underneath the surface to wherever the locator went. And those pings, you have sent me analysis of where you think maybe they should be looking. Can you try to explain for a general audience what you know about sound channels, pingers, and what might have happened in this case?
I spent 25 years in the Navy flying in P-3s as a tactical coordinator and mission commander, and our primary mission was anti-submarine warfare. We chased submarines based on the acoustic information that we would receive. In ocean depths, sound can travel great distances in what's called a deep sound channel. A deep sound channel is almost like a waveguide when you think about electronics. Speed of sound changes with temperature and depth. So what I did is, assuming that the signal strength on that ping was similar for pings they picked up at positions 1, 3, and 4, I assumed that they probably picked them up at around the same range away from the black box. And if you draw a circle that's about 12 and a half kilometers in radius around each of those pings, those three circles intersect in one spot, and they intersect in a position that's about 3.5 kilometers to the east of ping number 2. There is a yellow line that goes from northeast to southwest that passes almost directly through the intersection of those three circles. And that is the computer-generated arc from the Intelsat signal. The satellite was pinging the aircraft, and it's the arc that we've heard about where Intelsat said, we believe it's on the southern arc. So if, in fact, that plane was on that arc, to me, it's more than coincidence that it crosses right where those three circles intersect.
Do you think that they're going to find this plane down where you have the illustration at pinger number 2?
If, in fact, the signals that they received are from the Malaysian Flight 370 black box, then yes, I think that's where they're going to find it. But with everything else that's happened, I wouldn't be surprised if they don't find it.
Ever?
Ever.
Wow. It's like Amelia Earhart on steroids.
Oh, exactly. It's bad enough to have to deal with a tragedy, but where is it? Mm-hmm. That has made the human tragedy of this that much greater.
And George, I hope you and the Coast audience will go to my news website, earthfiles.com, and on the headlines page are hot links to each of these reports tonight. And this one, strange disappearance of MH370, impossible location, there is a... this graphic that Captain Wood sent me that he generated based on the making these circles around the pings. And you can go and click on it. It comes up large. And when you look at it and you see that the Inmarsat satellite, that yellow line, is going through almost exactly where the circles from the different pingers intersect, and it is going to be very interesting if in some distant future they do find something exactly where retired Captain Wood has shown. As you look at this, the science of it makes some sense, but being down there with those drones is a whole other issue of trying to find something. As we know, that happened with the French plane that took them 2 years to find that. And there's been another news development just today, and that is the families are so frustrated at this sort of the door sort of constantly being slightly left open about what has or has not happened to MH370, and the Malaysian Prime Minister not exactly closing the door. And now we have learned that the Malaysians sent their preliminary report to an official body but have not shared it with the families.
That's right.
And so Boeing, which is a public traded company and makes the 777, is going to have stockholder meetings next week. And now some of the people that have relatives on that plane want to go and demand from Boeing that because they have fiduciary responsibility that they try to help these people. And there was a very interesting quote today from passenger relative Sarah Bach. She said, the Malaysians seem to be choosing to treat us as if we are the enemy, as opposed to an interested party looking to solve the mystery.
Yeah, it is indeed one of the strangest stories ever.